Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Team Human is an ad-free, listener-supported project made possible by teammates like Joanne, Courtney, Mark Gasway, Joel Calloway, Wolfie, and hopefully you. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support to find the others who gain access to our Discord channel, my paywalled Medium posts, archives of my writing and conversations, and participation in our live Team Human salons in the Kibitz Room. We're having our next live discussion on December 9th at 2 p.m. New York time, 7 p.m. UK time, and 11 a.m. West Coast time. See you there. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to say for ourselves what constitutes signal and what constitutes noise, a celebration of the mistakes and anomalous behaviors that constitute life in a reality increasingly optimized for predictable, utilitarian outcomes. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, the filmmaker behind thoughtful, pro-human movies including Lapsus and the documentary In Silico, Noah Hutton.
Interestingly, those same people who become devotees of the Church of Statistics end up needing to recapture some of the special sauce at some point. Like they become desperate for the special sauce of humanity in their apps and their in searching for creatives to start using their tools. And, you know, it's funny how when you go in deep into the world of deep learning, it's like dying for artists.
Noah will be helping us recognize the power and perfection in what might otherwise be considered our failings and mistakes. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. I've been working on a piece. I was originally going to write it for The Atlantic, but it seems like it's going to be easier to write it for a home audience with, you know, some degree of common knowledge of the kinds of things I'm thinking about. And it's called What's a Metaphor? And I guess it's an extension of some of the ideas in Survival of the Richest, which I'm still hoping y'all think about getting, because it'd be nice to have the community. Having read that book, I would love it to be part of our common vocabulary. But this is called, it's called Going Meta. Let me share what I've got so far. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg may one day be remembered less for his social network or his Oculus virtual reality platform than his introduction of the term meta into popular awareness. With two parts desperation over a declining subscriber base and one part hope that he could breathe new life into his dying business model, Zuck announced that he'd be dedicating his time and the company's capital into the supposed next generation of digital life. Facebook became a holding company called Meta. This notion of going meta has been around a long time, at least since the first play within a play in Elizabethan theater. But where meta theater tends to make audiences more aware of the artifice of the play, Zuckerberg's Meta is intended to do the opposite, to fully immerse the user in an alternate digital reality. For in its new incarnation, Meta has less to do with dramatic irony than a hunger for transcendence, escape, and dominion that characterizes Silicon Valley titans from Zuckerberg and Bezos to Thiel and Musk. See Survival of the Richest if you want to laugh at how preposterous yet common this mindset has become. Embracing a mishmash of undefined virtual reality and blockchain technologies for the even less defined Web3, Zuckerberg intends Meta to level up the internet and reframe everything we currently think of as digital technology. The same way TV could be thought of as going meta on movies, or Netflix could be seen as going meta on TV, or aggregation platforms like Facebook went meta on individual websites, Meta is intended to just go meta on everything. It's one big map that replaces the many territories. By staking such a claim, Zuckerberg does us all a great favor. He may not be able to build such a thing, but he's revealing the faulty foundations of the Silicon Valley mindset, which is to transcend whatever problems we may be facing by rising above the real world and escaping to the next one, going meta. Like salvation to a Christian, enlightenment to a Buddhist, or the IPO to a venture capitalist, going meta and operating at least one level above the mere mortals down here on terra firma has become the ultimate goal of any self-respecting tech titan. Conditions on the ground, if they're even acknowledged, are mere externalities to the greater mission to venture beyond our world and to the next one. To Jeff Bezos, the planet on which the rest of us live is simply the solid surface against which his Blue Origin craft can push against as it journeys upward to the heavens, just as his employees and customers provide the earthly fuel and funding for him to reach escape velocity. He proved he could amass enough capital by going meta on online retail and aggregating everyone else's businesses into one big platform of platforms that he could achieve himself what Americans could achieve collectively over 60 years ago. For Peter Thiel, founder of PayPal and Palantir, going meta means exponentialism, or as he puts it in the title of his business book, rising from zero to one. Adapting his Stanford philosophy professor René Girard's theories of mimicry, scapegoating, and Christian ascension to the business world, Thiel argues that the successful builder of the future must operate at least 10x or one order of magnitude above the competition. Competition is for losers, Thiel famously quipped. One must level up instead. It's akin to the digital business phenomenon that tech publisher Tim O'Reilly called Web 2.0, where developing applications isn't enough for internet companies. They must think of their products as platforms on which other companies' applications can run. Only then are they in a position to commodify everything one order of magnitude beneath themselves. So with examples like this, it's no wonder everyone wants to go meta. But there's also something about this moment in history that motivates the quest for a new sort of escape hatch. The ongoing pandemic, political violence, fear of our own neighbors, and catastrophic thinking, they all combine to make our lives more isolated and digitally dependent. There's been a shift, an increase in both real-world threats and virtual opportunities, encouraging us to experience as much reality as possible through the safety of our smartphone screens. From a safe remove, we can control the chaos of incoming symbols through internalized binary switches, friend, foe, like Block, woke, MAGA. The further we can reduce the real world to bits, the more easily we can swipe left, and the more we are enabled to escape the complicated mess of reality and go meta ourselves. Besides, in a media environment where digital symbols dictate activity in the physical world, reality doesn't stand a chance. Derivative financial instruments and ultra-fast trading so completely dominate the stock market that the New York Stock Exchange was actually purchased by its derivatives exchange in 2013. So the stock market, which was already an abstraction of the human marketplace, was consumed by its own abstraction. Or consider Bitcoin, the crypto funeral pyre through which we prove our devotion to a coin by burning what is left of the planet's limited energy store. We don't do this proof of work to accomplish or serve any function other than to prove we have done it. It is quite literally the process through which we convert atoms to bits, reality to its metastasizing counterpart. What distinguishes such efforts from their real-world analogs is their utter disconnection from the ground and disregard for whoever is living back there on it. In Zuckerberg's demo of Meta, virtual people float around with nothing from the waist down. Legs are coming next year. It's a paradise for anyone who doesn't want to deal with the soil, friction, or genitals, not to mention the tent villages of homeless people on the edge of Facebook's corporate campus. Like transhumanist Ray Kurzweil uploading his brain to Google's processors, or tech investor Sam Altman migrating his consciousness to an AI cloud, the dream is to transcend the chrysalis of matter and metamorphose from nature into the technosphere. But the implications, they may be more profound and hazardous than ditching one's vinyl Beatles albums for a Spotify account. First off, unlike an old record collection, the natural environment and human condition can't simply be relegated to a dumpster. Yet the exponentialists have cherry-picked from another half-baked philosophy, effective altruism, to justify exactly that. As best as I can cobble it together from Elon Musk's and others' tweets, as well as the writings of philosophers Nick Bostrom and William McCaskill, from which they're cribbed, we can eschew the on-the-ground reality of today's 8 billion or so humans for the benefit of the future trillions of humans and human-based AIs who will spread throughout the galaxy once SpaceX develops a decent warp drive. The ends justify the means, especially when the ends are meta. Well, that's as far as I got this week. I'm going to write next week about what happens when we're keeping our eyes on the omega point at the end of the strange attractor at the end of time, rather than conditions on the ground, and see how we might be able to kind of reframe this conversation back to what matters in matter rather than what doesn't matter after matter. All right. Thanks.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Noah Hutton is a writer and director of documentary narrative films. He actually reached out to me because he recognized some ideas in Team Human that resonated with what he was discovering in his own work. Specifically, the idea that part of what animates and drives life, and humans in particular, are the errors. How do you know something is made by hand, except for the imperfections? How does something evolve, except by making what may at first appear to be mistakes? What is the signal, and what is the noise? And does a world dominated by the values of auto-tuning lose track of that? Noah's 2021 sci-fi feature Lapsus was nominated for a Spirit Award and opened at South by Southwest. It's a beautiful, understated fantasy about the ultimate gig work reality. And his 2020 documentary, In Silico, followed a 10-year project to simulate the human brain on supercomputers. Spoiler alert, they did not succeed. But Hutton sure did, and I'm really glad he reached out. This is a weird way to start, but you actually reached out to me because you saw how much your own work and stuff resonates with my work and stuff. I mean, and you've been at it for years now, as have I. And I looked at a bunch of your work. I'm not finished with Lapsus yet. I'm three quarters of the way through of this cabling adventure, which is available on Apple. That's where I got it for like $3.95. I rented it as a movie and watched it on my big monitor. It's kind of cool, but it's a beautiful little movie. And it's not what I actually want to talk about. It's the movie before this, a documentary you did called In Silico. But where do you see your overlap? What attracts you to the sort of the Team Human meme, and how do you see your work kind of promoting this humanism in a digital age?
I guess you've been particularly acute in your defense of the human in an age when sort of everything is coming for the human, technologically speaking, and siphoning the sort of nobility of biological life with terminology like neural networks and, you know, deep learning. And so I've been somewhat critical, maybe not so much in the films we're going to talk about, but just overall about the use of biological language to describe our technologies. Mm. You know, when I saw you talking about the soul in these last years, I just felt such a resonance with sort of Aristotle's notion of formal cause. And I just love the way you remind everyone of the humanness of human in an age where we're often meant to think that computers have caught up in many ways to where we are and are soon to overtake us. I think it's just so important to draw some lines in the sand and to give some dignity back to people because they deserve it.
It's interesting. You use words like, you know, dignity and nobility. And then when you talk about lines in the sand, I go straight back to like the Bible, right? Lines in the sand, the original sand, you know, out in the desert, you know, I keep thinking about the Israelites fighting for human dignity, you know, against Pharaoh and the death cults and the way that, you know, at least what that religion was trying to teach. I think mainstream Judaism may have lost the plot a bit, but what the religion was trying to teach was that once you have an idol or an icon and you project or you anthropomorphize it or you see it as human, you can lose track of what the human is, you know. it's worse. It's like I remember in the early tech days we used to like put like rabbit ears on a Mac Classic, you know, you have a name for it, or your name for a car, and it was sweet, but no one really took it that seriously. It was more like superstition. But now it's like, I feel like the computer puts like a little rabbit ears on us. You know, it is literally,
that's right.
You know, with your Instagram, you got your filter and it's like, oh, look at that cute little human.
That's right. That's kind of like you have this concept. You talk about technology auto-tuning humanity. Mm. And that's exactly that. I love that idea. And I feel like that's all around us. It's almost like the danger these days is us getting dragged down to some level, right?
Yeah, I know. Like it used to be, I'm scared of the machines are going to be too smart.
Right, overtaking
and now
us.
It's like people just being too stupid. That's the machine's real plot. Not to get smarter than us, just to make us dumber than them.
That's right. That might be the way to win. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Whatever. The other thing is like, and I haven't seen the end of it. Neither of your films gets into this, your movies gets into this directly. But when you're speaking, I'm reminded of, I had a long time resistance to both McLuhan and Postman as media theorists, because both of them ended up falling back on religion as some sort of a defense against technology, you know, or spirit. And there is this place when you use words like dignity and nobility, it's either like, oh, so there's a queen that gives us nobility, or what gives you dignity? What's makes humans or life somehow something other than silicon and some other emergent intelligence is in some ways you got to go back to faith. You know, the only thing we really have over tech is our faith that we are something other than tech.
Yeah, that's a good question. That I guess is the question for us in a rather atheistic age is if it's not religion, what is the ennobling factor? What gives us the dignity in our humanity? And for me, in the documentary In Silico, it's this concept of noise, weirdly. It's the stochasticity. There's so many words for it. I mean, noise, stochasticity, randomness, error, you know, there's a entropy. There's a way in which that became for me in that project a very sort of mystical feature of life that is the ultimate line in the sand for me. It's what gave me hope leaving the project that technology is not coming for us anytime soon. And we can get into, you know, more specifically all about that. But that was actually a nice thing to come to at the end of a decade of making a film.
Yeah. No, that was a really deep movie. I mean, it was very, very, very trippy for me. For people who don't know, it was basically one of these. It reminds me of like when Rick Linkletter does a movie over like 9 decades or 7 Up or 21 Up, you know, one of those. So this was 10 years following one project, right? It's basically the brain, the digital brain project in the UK or at Oxford or something, right?
It's originally the Blue Brain Project in Switzerland and led by a scientist named Henry Markram. And he gave basically this all started because, rightly so, I was swept away in my 22-year-old sort of like on awestruck state by a TED talk. At that time in 2009, TED sort of occupied a bit of a different place, I think, in the cultural landscape, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe it's not exactly where it was then and they're still around, but I was just coming out of college. I was hit at the exact perfect moment. I had read this guy's papers. I had studied neuroscience as an undergraduate student. Mm-hmm. I was enamored by him as a biological scientist. Then he gives this TED talk. And he says, you know, in the TED talk, he says, I'm going to simulate a human brain in 10 years. I'm going to send a hologram back to TED to give a talk in my stead. And the crowd goes nuts, you know, and I hear it and I'm starting to get into documentaries. And so I basically decided to attach a 10-year documentary timeline to his 10-year brain simulation timeline.
Right. You just emailed him and said, I want to follow you over 10 years.
I emailed a couple times to get a response, and it was a NYU neuroscientist, Joe Ledoux, who I did a music video for his rock band, The Amygdaloids.
Oh my
and
God.
Just, you know, a random.
a video for a neuroscience teacher's rock band. Okay.
That's right. That was a real kismet
Beautiful.
Moment because then,
yeah,
because
apparently.
Then Joe emailed Henry in this small world of elite neuroscientists and said, hey, I can vouch for this kid. I know he wants to make this documentary, you know, you should let him, whatever. So I got access by the help of Joe Ledoux, and I went over there and I started making these yearly trips.
Right. I was figuring you had it. You're not going to just live there for 10 years.
No, it was a while. First of all, the Swiss franc is not a great conversion. It's very expensive. And I could only go for about 3 or 4 days. I was paying for it with like freelance, you know, videography work. So that was where it started, and I started from this very awe-inspired, zero criticism place, and probably good, because I probably wouldn't have started making the film had I had the critique I have now. So on one hand, that kind of critical, free thinking allowed me to dive in fully and commit my own resources to following what I thought was this incredible project, you know?
Right, that you really believe, and it sounded to you like in 10 years, he was going to send back something, some kind of hologram that was going to then interact and maybe pass the Turing test with these people.
Exactly. That was the promise, you know, he had a set of milestones to get there. And I thought, well, even if it's not a full human brain doing a Turing test, maybe, you know, it's going to be something. This is huge. This guy is legit. He's getting all this money. The IBM supercomputers have been committed. I'm going to see what happens. Something's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it took a few twists and turns from there. Yeah.
And then rather early on, when you're sort of going through kind of the evolution and development of life, you know, of life and consciousness, it feels almost like you happen upon a discovery or an assertion that the way life develops is through errors. And I'm sure everyone's listening going, oh, duh, of course that's what it is. But I had never really thought of evolution as errors. I always think of them as wins. You know, it's like, oh, you got gills, so you knew how to breathe, and you got hands, so you know how to do that. But it's actually, there was like error in the system. And it just happens that that error turned out to be good, right? That it worked. But the way that you know, what you kept coming back to in this movie is like, for me anyway, and I'm watching it in my own strange, trippy way, but the way you know something is truly alive and conscious is that it makes mistakes.
Yeah, that's so crucial.
But it does. It cuts across every wrong theory of society. Like, you know, the human beings make rational economic choices. It's like, of course not. If we made rational economic choices, we'd be stocks. You know?
Right. That's right. But isn't it funny? I think that the logic of sort of capitalist economy has so pervaded our thoughts, even about the way biological evolution unfolded, that we have a kind of like rise and grind mindset about Darwinian evolution, where it's like, no, every organism was just rising and grinding every day trying to find its win. And it's like, no, that's not how it went, actually.
Right, like little Pac-Man. Yeah, just
that's right. Yeah. It's like, no, they were rising and making mistakes. And then this blind force was selecting for these, for, you know, so I think that's just a wonderful reframing of evolution that for me was a seismic shift in thinking. Maybe that is very obvious for many people.
Right. But it's not. It is a seismic shift. It is, because then it's like, the thing that was so seismic about it for me, it's like, if you're going around the world trying to figure out what's alive? You're just like looking around, like the world's almost dead. You're just looking for living things. You look for anomalous behavior. It's like, that's how you know that there's human will in it.
Right.
It's like, you know, and then it goes, I was watching and I started to think, oh, that's what Adam and Eve's story was about. That's why they got to take the apple from the tree. They had to how do they know they're alive unless they do something wrong? Right. So God sets up this thing. It's all perfect. There's one thing you could do that's wrong, and that's take a bite of that thing, and you get knowledge. Right. You're going to get knowledge from that, but it's wrong. And of course they go do it because they're fucking alive, you know. And it was like, oh, you figured out. You figured out the secret of life. It's doing wrong.
That's right. And one, you know, an important thing is, like, in a way, what's wrong and right in those situations? Like, they're just doing different things. Some things are more successful and they get selected for, whatever. But I think it's helpful to use the terminology wrong or mistake or error, because we do live in an age where we are building perfect machines that we say are emulating life. So it's important. And, you know, every time there's a mistake in code, we get rid of the mistake. We hide it. We get rid of we debug. You know, we cleanse the mistake. So I think it is actually important to use that language, because
cleanse. I love the cleanse.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We try to cleanse the mistakes in humanity as well. And we know where that goes. But that we debug it. But the other thing is that there's a difference between the kind of mistake that we're talking about here and what computer people would call noise. Noise is like random. Noise is what you throw on, like when you're trying to make a font look smoother on a cheap computer. Back in the old days, they threw random pixels. It was called anti-aliasing. Random pixels to make it look rounder to the eye, sort of blurry to make it look round. When you want an AI to seem more human, you throw in noise. Literally noise, randomness, to make it seem more human. But in the humans, that's not randomness. That's actually, there's something motivating it. Usually there's something going on. It's just it just wasn't what we had a metric for at that particular moment.
That's right. What's the who are we to decide what the signal and the noise is, right? In biology. So you're absolutely right. There's two different things going on there. And they throw noise in this brain simulation I've made this film about. You know, they have very sophisticated, they call them random number generators that they use to throw, and they call it jitter in these biological networks to kind of give them what they perceive to be the right amount of noise. And there's a crucial moment in my 10 years of making this film, and that appears in the final film. And it's sort of like, for me, it's the most important moment in the film. And it's finally, I'm pursuing this story about the variability in biology and how it's going to be captured in the machines, in the simulation of the brain, the perfect simulation of the brain. And I asked one of the junior scientists there, how do you capture the right amount of variability? You know, how do you put the right amount of jitter in? How do you know it's the right amount of randomly generated numbers that you're throwing into the simulation? And she kind of looks at me for a second. She goes, well, I guess we could never know what's the right amount, you know? And it was the first crack in this edifice of kind of like Silicon Valley, entrepreneurial, puffed up. We've got everything. We've got a vision. We just need the money to do it, and give us 10 years and no questions asked. It was the first moment someone give a little bit of a sign that there was a sort of mystery and a deep unknown at the core of the question they were trying to answer.
Right. Well, that's not the same year though that there was one year where the guy wouldn't talk to you when he was kind of shaved. It's like, we could not get, he did not speak to us this year. It's like, you came over. It was your one yearly thing to meet this guy. You're making a 10-year movie and he is so embarrassed. Was that the same year as that? Or that was a different year, but it was the same energy.
That was slightly before that, but it's kind of, So I got stood up by him after, you know, my yearly trip. And it was, getting stood up was what set me on this path of having to like find something else I was interested about to keep making this film. I got kind of like bored.
Right.
I kept kind of getting the same answer every time I would go there. And I didn't really know where it was going. I didn't know. I certainly knew that at this point they weren't going to get a human brain at the end of the decade. So I didn't really know what I was arbitrarily pinning my own decade on at that point. So I kind of needed a new direction. And I got interested in this question of noise as my sort of my central thesis moving forward. So yeah, then I went and asked her that question and got that response.
Which is beautiful. I mean, and then it's also, I mean, not to get too autodidactic or whatever it is about it, but you as the human filmmaker represented the noise in their system. Do you know what I mean? you get that sense that after a while, it's like, oh my gosh, they're being observed, you know, and they're aware that they're being observed. And it's like, oh, their little perfect world is like, I mean, of course they had to answer to funders too, I think was their biggest sort of obstacle. So if they're not really doing it, not like, it's not they're going to lose it over 10 years, although they had to reapply, but it's like, yeah, the hubris. I mean, that's the other beautiful thing in the story. This guy who really does start out, you think of him, and nothing against him, you think of him as a pure, just genius scientist. You see how the hubris takes hold, you know, I mean, in any of us, but it does, because you just think you're right and you got all these machines and money and stuff and models.
Yeah, but there's, you know, that's not all scientists don't do that when they get funding. There's a certain personality type that turns off towards criticism and doesn't have dialogue with dissent and sort of
That doesn't tolerate, you know, error, that can't doesn't wiggle.
Right, exactly. We can extend this metaphor all across, up and down the project and the thing it's building. But they didn't tolerate the error of dissenting opinion. You know, looking to build consensus was sorely missing. And it led to this giant open letter and 800 scientists, you know, signing on to say that the direction of the project was misguided and that the funding was being misallocated, and huge rupture. And that was sort of the midway point for me. And he was booted from what was then called the Human Brain Project. It was €1 billion to do this in Europe. And Henry Markram, the scientist I was following, left and, you know, went back to his own project. And that's soon after that is when I got stood up and had to find all this, you know, my own interest in noise and so forth. But yeah, that metaphor kind of goes all the way up and down the whole thing.
Right. And that's where humans get in trouble, is when there is no room for error, because practically speaking, human beings probably are in error, right?
Right.
We're this anomaly. We're this mistake. But like, as a filmmaker, I mean, as you're a filmmaker, I'm a book writer. I mean, as a book writer, I've survived within the margin of error on the balance sheet of the publishing company. Right. There, publishing companies in the old day, they weren't even on computer, much less part of giant corporations. You know, Bantam and Doubleday or Dell, they were not part of Random House, which was part of Bertelsmann. You know, they were weird little places. And your book made money or it didn't. And it's like, no, it didn't make money, but don't worry about it because this one, Angela, I remember when they told me Angela Lansbury's autobiography made a lot of money and it's okay. We're sort of spreading it around. It's okay if yours didn't. It's fine. You know, they always, there was wiggle. You know what I mean? It was like nobody noticed. You kind of had enough margin of error that there, a lot of us could just live in those spaces. We just, that's where art happens. You know, there's like a, your uncle, oh, he's not using the bar anymore. Well, if I happen to leave the keys on the coffee table and you happen to use it for a play, who am I to know that you did a play in the closed bar, you know, which is what we did. And it's like, do you have a fire license or this? It was like, there was just, we lived in a world where there was just wiggle room. And I feel like somehow capitalism and technology are combining to take all that away. That's, you know, I'm watching your poor guy, this poor dude in your movie Lapsus. It's like, you can't get away with anything in his world. You try to lie down to catch your breath and your little machine in your pocket says, you know, rest tonight, you know, don't rest now, you know, that's good. Push your limits, you know, and again, it's capitalism and technology. It's like the balance sheet of capitalism where everything is accounted for and even scarier surveillance potential of technology combine to really make error, if you want to call it that, to make noise, to make humanness illegal.
Yeah, right. And it's sort of, you know, another aspect of this, which involves the kind of erasure of error is that I get into the film is the idea that when you simulate the brain in this big project they're trying to do and, you know, that is ongoing, that certainly didn't get to the finish line for this film, but imagining that if this did happen and you get a generic model of the brain, like whose brain is that? And that's a unique question that we haven't been faced with yet. Like, you know, it's kind of like a march forward to it, just like we did with the pacemaker. You know, we kind of get a model of an organ and that's great. That makes much more sense for the heart. I get that. We could want like sort of a healthy, safe, productive, ideal model of a heart. And then you kind of march that forward to, okay, but we'll just continue and we'll do the brain.
Yeah, you go to the brain supply and get Abby Normal, remember?
Right. So like what, you know, nowhere was I hearing conversations about what the human brain is. Whose brain is that, right? And there's such an assumption that's made every little decision you make on your path to making a model of anything. But when it is the seat of humanity, you've decided what the normal middle of the bell curve is for all these tiny little properties on your way to deciding the normal of the middle of the bell curve brain as a whole. And that's a profound process that I think is ahead of us that isn't so sci-fi, because I think it'll happen much sooner without having to build a full digital simulation of the human brain. We'll just get that process happening for, you know, various traits before the whole.
Well, you don't need a human brain. I mean, you won't get a human brain. Now, a human brain needs a human body, needs the human soup, the environment in which the brain lives, you know, is the nurture of that organ. So when they're building a brain, they're building a computer brain, right? It's a different...
That's right.
Thing.
It is fundamentally different. Yeah. They talk about it like it is the biology.
I know. And that's what I always want. Do they talk about it as biology because that's what they believe or because that's like their marketing? I remember Luke, who our engineer, he got me on this panel at IBM Watson and they kept saying, well, you know, Watson is 60% sure of this and Watson 70% sure of that. And
I'm like, I know.
I get the 70%, but Watson's sure? Does Watson have an experience of confidence? And it's like, oh, well, that's the language you're using. I said, why is that the language you're using? Isn't that a little... Oh, so people could understand. No, it's not so people could understand. It's so people can believe something that's not true.
Right. It's fascinating, isn't it? It's like now these days, I just noticed in the last couple months watching sports, different sports, tennis, basketball, football, and across all sports now, they bring in, and I think it's Watson. I mean, they bring in AI to say there's a 17.9% chance of this field goal being made from this thing. And then the kicker kicks it in. Misses. They go, Watson pretty. And you know, same thing.
That's for bettors, I think. That's for people betting on the side or whatever.
Right,
but maybe I know what you mean, all that. But yeah, and then you try to watch a baseball game now, and it's like, because they have all this data on where people's balls hit, they reposition. They call it the shift. And you shift the outfield and the infield around, so the guy is standing there. And sure enough, usually the guy hits it, and then the fielder just has to put his glove, like, 2 feet high, and it's there, you know? It's like...
Right, right. So you watch baseball. Do you like the idea of getting rid of the umpire behind home plate?
No! Okay. No! Because
that's coming, right? Didn't they? I heard
them
say that this is the last year of the strike zone.
It's bad. Yeah. It's bad because... Because they're... Those guys represent the law. You know? These are human beings. They're... The umps are a team on the field who are trying to do another thing. I mean, it's like if it's just right or wrong, you kill so much. I mean, how the catcher shows where the ball was. You know, the guy makes it, it's a little bit off the plate. And the catcher, you catch it in a motion so that you end your catch behind the plate and create the illusion that it was behind. That's the game. That's part of the, it's not cheating. It's the game. You know, and I would argue getting rid of the umps is what you do in a fascist society.
I like that. I agree. I mean, I think it's so profoundly boring to get rid of the human element in these situations. I think the same is true for tennis. I don't know if you watch tennis at all, but now they've gotten rid of the line judges so that when the ball, you know, when
so
the ball.
So then Bobby McEnroe, how do you get a Bobby McEnroe? I mean, it's from my youth. This guy, he was this little angry tennis player. He would like throw his tennis racket at the guy up on this. There were these judges. They were like, on the line where the net is, and they're up on like lifeguard chairs, and he would like throw his racket at these guys and throw a tantrum. What's he going to throw a tantrum at? A computer? At a laser? Right.
No, I know. What do you even look at? Who do you argue with? You're just sort of in alone. It's profoundly isolating.
Right. And it's all wrong. I mean, then it just encourages us to do that in life and then to use like algorithms instead of judges. And the algorithms end up not just more racist than the original judges on whom they're based because they've iterated their racism.
That's right. Yeah. Right. That's the dark truth is that they actually end up regressing society, not right. But
yeah.
And that's where we end up with this brain model we're talking about is that you end up getting when you get a normative model of what the human brain is in this case. What metrics do you derive from that then get used in like calculating your whether you can get a mortgage or not? You know, what goes into that? You have your credit score these days. You have, you know, various other metrics that are used to calculate whether you're, you know, able to get a loan or something.
Right. Your FICO score, which is still based in some of the greenlining algorithms from, you know, from the segregation era.
Right. So it feels very much like the momentum is towards throwing in normative models of the body when, as this technology goes into the core, into those same conversations. And that I think is the line in the sand for me. But the reason why I think it's exciting to draw the line in the sand and ennoble the human again is that these models won't capture the noise. And I think that's why they won't succeed. And I think that's a good thing because it protects us from having a normative model of the brain decide whether we get a mortgage or not.
Right. And it's partly because, you know, the science people, you know, for lack of a better lump to throw people in, the science people are have faith in kind of the predictive value of statistics. You know, and they can say, and it's honest to say, look, if you go do that, you know, there's a 90% chance you will fail if you do that. So do this instead. But life, Judaism, Christianity, America, digital things were all based in one of those 10% people going and fucking doing it anyway. Like, right. There's a 90% chance right. I will fail, but I want to try it. Let's just right. see. What does this right. button do? You know, and it's that, that's what makes life. That's, right. but oddly enough, it's like the tech entrepreneurs who took wild, crazy bets become orthodox members of the statistics and probability community as soon as they've had their success. It's like, right. and that's odd. You know, that's the machine learning universe that what we're talking about moving into. Yeah. You know, and I guess, yes, and it's hard. They could say, I understand it's unethical to do anything else, you know, but without that 10% room for anomaly, for noise, for innovation, for the path less traveled, we don't make any progress at all.
Right. And interestingly, those same people who become devotees of the Church of Statistics end up needing to recapture some of the special sauce at some point. Like they become desperate for the special sauce of humanity in their apps and in searching for creatives to start using their tools. And, you know, it's funny how when you go in deep into the world of deep learning, it's like dying for artists. It's like these art, deeply learned art tools need to mine artists' work in order to generate all these images we're seeing, and they wouldn't be able to otherwise. So there's this sort of a massive IP problem too, I think, in that sphere, because where does the special noise come from if it's not mined from the people who still are operating in that space, you know?
Well, then they'll go to South America and do some ayahuasca with someone. It's like, you know what I mean? They're so desperate for noise that they've got to get it in one big $5,000 mega dose, you know? It's like, okay,
right.
Here's that's right. Inject some yeah. novelty into this dead brain.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Oi.
Well.
Oi. And I mean, without giving anything away, there's a character in your newer movie, Lapsus, which is I would call it a human-scaled science fiction movie. It's sort of, when I say human-scaled, I mean more like kind of like the Alex Garland scale of movie. Or Alex Garland, I would say Alex Garland meets fast-moving Tarkovsky.
Wow, I'll take that. Doug,
you know what I mean?
You.
Because Tarkovsky, yeah. he made this movie called, was it called The Stalker?
Stalker, yeah. I watched that. I watched that before I made this movie. It was a big influence for sure.
So
yeah.
there. So yeah. it's not totally stupid. You know what yeah. I mean? There's a stalker element to this sure. to this movie. Stalker. It's not about a stalker like what we think of a stalker. It's about this guy who can take people on trips through a strange kind of a post-nuclear area, or maybe post-nuclear area of Russia, where like weird like laws of physics don't really work, and he can kind of walk you through there. It's this weird. He's just a weird filmmaker, but it's wonderful stuff. So on some level, this movie would work with or without the technology. The technology becomes a metaphor in some ways for, you know, a certain approach to civilization. But yeah. there's a character, the brother of the protagonist, has a sort of an Epstein Barr, a fictional Epstein Barr like disease that, you know, we must believe is whatever the 5G towers are doing to us, it's this, you know, it's like hive collapse, you know, and a lot of, I know a lot of people who have it, and I don't have it. I don't like to think too much about it, but I get waves of it. I've experienced waves of, I mean, I used to call it present shock for that book, but waves of digital nausea almost. And I don't mean to be superstitious, and I don't mean that I feel it from the cell tower, but I kind of empathize with nature being disturbed and fried, you yeah. know? I mean, I get burned out by my work, but there's this other level of fry.
Yeah.
You know, which is the other threat, right? It's not just being neutralized by the balance sheet. there's no room for noise, but it's almost on a, I think what you're trying to communicate is that then on a biological, on a cellular level, we need to enact this noise, and it's getting overwhelmed. Like the sounds of the whales in the ocean are overwhelmed by our Navy sonar bullshit stuff. They can't even hear. They're like going crazy down there.
Right.
Like our little bodies are doing that too.
Yeah. And then the cause is nonspecific. We can't say it's the towers. We can't say it's, you know, the Wi-Fi router. It's because ultimately it probably isn't one of the things if it's any of that stuff, but yet it kind of could be all of it together in a nonspecific, multidimensional way. You know, I purposefully wrote it as this kind of malaise that it also, I think, was drawn from, you know, people's struggling with CFS, a chronic fatigue syndrome, and chronic conditions that are related to that, which often people are ridiculed for because they've, you know, sort of made to feel like they're it's
fake
all psychosomatic.
Disease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just believe that in our world today, there are these multivariate, you know, components that are affecting us in ways that we'll never maybe unlock. This combined with that, this thing we're eating combined with this frequency we're receiving. And it's so complex, and it's hard not to get your tinfoil hat on and decide you think you know what it is because you want to assign cause and effect somewhere. But that's another thing that's so blame.
Oh, right? Cause and effect. Gates with his thing and this. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's another thing that fries you because it's hard. You can't really, you know, you can't do the research to figure out if it's the 5G tower. Where do you even start as an individual?
You can't isolate a cause anymore because we're in this soup.
Right. So that was something I was trying to capture, was not just the actual syndrome itself, which is probably real, but the malaise of trying to figure out what it is and being re-exhausted, you know, invigorated and then re-exhausted by the pursuit of truth for yourself as an individual making sense of all of this. So that's in the film. Yeah. And it's a condition we called omnia, and we made the film in 2019. And then, you know, the film was released right in the midst of the pandemic. A couple of people, when they were reviewing the film, called it like the omnia thing pressing of COVID. And it's like not what you want to hear, really. It's like, it's not a positive thing, I think. It's like, oh God. But that is part of the story.
I mean, anyone who hasn't seen this movie won't know what I'm talking about. But basically, in Lapsus, these people are hired to go and lay cable through state parks for reasons that you don't need to know. But they're laying cable for this giant company. We don't know. It's like networking or something, just along the ground. And they do it. They've got these little, like, almost like old lady shopping carts, except instead of groceries, it's got a little spool with wire, and they just walk with this thing through these trails in the woods. But what holds the whole thing together is the sound of these little things. When they walk with them, you hear them like, it's like the little sound of the spool ongoing and the wheels trying to, you know, track through the woods. It's obviously that's real sound, right? That's real. You weren't foleying that. That was the sound. That was
no, that's the
that
sound of these things. Right. That's the sound of these carts.
But it's so, I can't tell you, it's so real that when you hear something real in a movie, it's partly your documentary maker in there. You're letting field sound happen.
Mm-hmm.
It grounds it in a reality that, I am here in the woods with this guy who's wheeling this thing. And it was a level of reality. And I've been watching a lot of, you know, Netflix and stuff since COVID, you know, these big production things. And nothing has struck me the way that sound did in terms of pulling me in to the reality that I'm there. And I'm like, oh, it's this low key reality sound. Even baseball now, when you watch it on Fox, they amplify like where the pitcher throws the ball and you hear whoosh, poof, like it hits the glove. Whoosh, poof, whoosh, poof. It's like, what is that? What baseball game do you go to and hear that? You know, they're amplifying it somehow or adding it in. And it was like, so there's something that understated level of reality grounds us into that what to me is the team human vibe, which is, you know, it's all here. It's just here. Just do less.
Right.
And
right. ultimately, if you're trying to move people on the level of their human selves, there's nothing that'll do it more than what's around. I don't know why you have to. What's the point of reaching for the synthetic? We had, I mean, right. we're made of the salt water. Like it's here, you know. Like just stick with it. Trust it.
Yeah, exactly. Know? It's like, you know, like if Albert Maysles made a feature film, it would look like this, right? It's just like, just leave the camera on, let the people do the fucking things,
right?
And the magic will happen. Just leave right. it. Leave it.
Right.
Don't mess with it.
It's so true. Yeah, so true. That's what the Frederick Wiseman documentaries. That's why I love his documentaries and anything, yeah, that's just observational of human behavior. It's endlessly fascinating. There's nothing really more you need to do. That's why, like, you know, I grew up loving Herzog documentaries because he does this incredible thing where he just interviews someone and then they're done speaking and he just leaves the camera running and it's just kind of weird for a few seconds. And, you know, they don't know if he's turned the camera off or not and they're sort of looking and nothing. And then he inevitably in the film, he brings in like some cello music and or some vocal, whatever it starts, you start to feel. And, but it's such a celebration. I mean, so I think some people look at that and they think he's making fun of people or sort of making them look like buffoons or fools. And I've always had the opposite reaction. I feel like he's giving a moment to sort of spirit after whatever words have been said. It's
exactly.
like, let's let whatever energy is here sit for a moment before we just cut to the next soundbite, totally. Which is what so
Let's
many
re-humanize.
Documentaries do. Yeah.
I did that. Actually, I did that and I copied him when I did at the end of Generation Like. It was this documentary I made for Frontline. And it's about these kids who do social media. And then at the very end, you know, there's this girl who's trying to get people to like her page and whatever. And she does her bit, she finishes it, and she puts down the camera. And it's the end of my documentary. And I just originally, we were going to end with her ending her bit, you know, okay, great, sign up, da da da, you know, see you next week, done. And it was like, we left our camera, it just happened to be on. And it was like 7 or 8 more seconds. She puts down the camera, she kind of sighs, and she looks around. You can see on her face, she's thinking, you know, I guess I'm done. I guess yeah. But then that sort of, there's a moment of sadness of like, is that it? And it was like, oh my God, that's the best moment in the film. Just leave it. Just leave it. And we left it. And it's like, it became this, for me, it was the whole reason to do the movie was for the 3 seconds of silence at the end.
Yeah.
You're right.
Beautiful.
But it's, you know what that is? It's ground instead of figure. It's like the which we're so bad at in the West. You know, you watch an Eastern movie, you watch a Kurosawa movie, and it's like 90% that and 10% action.
Right. Right. Why is it that we're, that's so not how we do things in the West.
I don't know. I win.
Right.
You know, it's like, I get it. It's who we are. It's very sweet in a way. It's sweet. It's childlike.
Yeah. I have a question for you because we mentioned religion earlier, you know, in passing, we were talking about it briefly, but I've been hearing people saying religion's coming back or whatever, you know, people are like going back to religion. I wondered if that's something on your radar at all, or if you, where you are right now on the role or the need for faith in this world. Is that something you actively think about and are all about these days? Or is your notion of soul kind of absorbed that for you?
Well, the notion of soul satisfies a lot of that for me. I mean, the problem with soul as a construct is most people think, oh, so the soul is the thing that lives after you're dead or floats out of your body as some ghost. And it was weird. I was watching a lot of these really bad Viking series and over there's like 5 different kind of Viking things in Netflix, Amazon land. And I actually was watching one and I watched the second season of another and thought it was the second season of the first one, but it was 2 totally different series. That's how similar they are to me. It's like some dashing guy with a mustache and, you know, with a blonde, you know, Viking girlfriend fighting against, you know, the British and the island of whatever that is. So that's how good I am. And there was a Barbarians one I confused with both of them. So it's all the same thing, but they talk about like, they make a pledge to someone and then it's like totally inappropriate to maintain the pledge, but they keep the pledge because of their honor. Mm-hmm. And I started to understand honor as soul. In other words, like if you go against what you've pledged, if you go against that without at least getting forgiven by the person you've pledged to, I could see why it's like you've dedicated your soul to something and now you're compromising your soul. So it started to feel very kind of Maya Angelou to me, the way she's like, you know, if you're in a room and someone like makes a crack about a disparaging remark about gay people and you don't stand up, part of you dies. You know, and I buy that. That's part of your soul dies. And your soul is not necessarily some God, religion, Jesus, Moses thing, but your soul is the intentionality of your existence. It's your faith that you have will of some kind, you know, and where are you directing that will, that you are impacting things. So once you realize that you are impacting, that you have volition, that requires a moral framework. There's no
right.
At least as I understand it, or either that or you move into total weirdo, you know, weird ass Peter Thiel self-sovereignty, something else, you know, something I don't understand. So, yeah. So I don't see it. I mean, a lot of people will get it from religion, and I don't mind religion because it's like, I don't mind outsourcing a lot of this moral work to professional moralizers like the rabbis or the priests who really churned it up. It's wrong. Just don't, you know, I don't have to work that out. You know what I mean? For myself, I trust them. It's just me. It's too weird. Don't do it. You know, but some things can be automatic, you know, and religion's good for that. So you just know I can do this, or you do the religion that you are given, or that, and by doing it, you end up absorbing some of the almost the mimetic charge that's in it. You know, you get something out of it that way. But, but yeah, I do think it's going to be our best defense against techno-capitalism, you know, against all three pillars. You know, there's this sort of accelerationist Marxism, which is scary and unforgiving. There's neoliberalism, which is scary and unforgiving. And now there's this sort of authoritarian blood and soil, which is scary and unforgiving. So I feel like some sort of soul work, some sort of respecting the sanctity of ourselves and one another's existence is sort of what keeps you from either any of those three anti-human poles.
Yeah, I like that. But does it align for you with any kind of metaphysical read of the physical world? Because when you first responded to the film, you were mentioning this idea. You read into the, you know, this idea that we've been talking about of noise, these what I call them tiny mistakes in silico in the film, as, you know, potentially some sort of sign from somewhere else, or it was some sort of you know, indication that this could be a logic or a rubric from another source. I wanted to hear more of your thoughts about that. I certainly think it's a big mystery. I don't know where I go with it, but I wondered what your thoughts are.
I think it's what they call the original sin. You know, it's the origin. Again, this is not scientific, so shoot me. Although there is a scientist who says it now. He wrote a book called Time's Arrow, a physicist. I think that consciousness precedes matter. I think there was awareness first, and it is expressing itself through matter and through us. I don't think of consciousness as an emergent phenomena of complex atoms and biology. If it comes first, it's a lot easier for me to understand Big Bang and physics and evolution and everything else. So when I see the errors in your schema and the schema of life, I see the errors as, that's the energy. That's like, I see life like those, you know, those documentaries where you see the little baby turtles and they get hatched and they run to the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, that energy. And I remember that energy.
What is that? It's undeniable. It's there. It's happening.
It's undeniable. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And when I saw that first, like, mention of, they made an error and that's how we got this, I was like, that's it. That's the sign of life. That's the sign of this formal cause for biology. It's the soul in this process.
Right. Yeah. And it's in everything. It's in every, you know, complex physical entity. It's this kind of rumbling up from this like fountain of something that keeps percolating and pushing things in different directions. It's sort of, I've just come to sort of see it as this grand mystery that I'm okay with, and I'm actually very happy that it's there. It's very reassuring that it's there because I don't even need to know it. I don't need to wrap my head around what it is, where it comes from, who it is. I just, I'm deeply reassured ultimately as a human that there's a great fountain, you know, inside all of us that for the time being feels rather untouchable in the yeah. technocratic sense.
Right. I think it is untouchable. Thank God. You know, I think it could be killed. I don't know that it's permanent, you know,
right.
but I think it defies metrics. I think it defies quantization.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's, again, that's reassuring.
It is.
Yeah.
Profoundly so.
Yeah. And you know, where we touch it, where we play with it is, and that's why it's so interesting you move from documentary to fiction. We play with it in fiction. That's why I'm in a similar, I'm following you there. I mean, I don't want to do another nonfiction work for a while. I was thinking to do a play, but now because putting up a play is so hard, I'm thinking to actually write it as a graphic novel, sort of a play script as a graphic novel, and then do it as a play after. Because graphic novels you can do in a theatrical sort of theatrical way.
Yes.
So I might play with it that way first to sort of get it down on paper. Because when you, to write a play, it's sort of like writing a movie. It's like you can't help but think as you're writing it, oh yeah, I'm really going to get to shoot this. I'm really going to get to stage this scene. You know what I mean? It's like so optimistic to write it.
It is,
which is why it's a good exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
but you did.
I wrote my movie to, knowing that I would have to get it all together in our backyard in upstate New York. So
yeah,
that's a more constrained way to write for sure. I'm like, okay, what could be possible? You know,
exactly.
But now I'm trying to write stuff that wouldn't be in, you know, in our backyard. And it is very optimistic, but you know, I think you, after Survival of the Richest, you could go with the fiction inside one of those bunkers. That's a place where I haven't seen, you know, in fiction yet that you might have some insight into.
Totally. Thanks so much for doing this, for doing your movies, for being on Team Human.
Thank you for watching the movies and responding to me. I didn't even have to go and make a music video for one of your friend's bands to get him to write to you.
Yeah,
as I did.
Of course,
but, you know,
not.
I, yeah.
Of course
you,
not.
You watched the movies you wrote. I really appreciate it, Doug. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you for
you
all your work
them.
Over the years. It's truly, you've truly inspired many of the philosophies I've come to believe into to my core. So I really appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you.
You've been on Team Human. Our guest today was filmmaker Noah Hutton. You can find out more about him and his movies at noahhutton.com. You can also find out about him and all of our guests at teamhuman.fm, where you can also become a supporting member of the team. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff. I will see you in the kibitz room. And you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.